Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. The wind is howling and the rain and snow are falling across San Diego County as we record our show this Friday afternoon. Hear how low the snow levels could go on our show today. There's been some changes since election night in the 79th and 75th Assembly districts, and we'll have the final results for you today. And one of them was a squeaker. The Department of Housing and Urban Development has some good news for disaster victims here locally, including mortgage relief. A young athlete from Santana High School is heading to the Olympics, and the community is pulling together with a fundraiser to help his parents, including the water polo coach at the high school, go watch him at the Paris Olympics. On Monday, San Diego County residents will have a rare glimpse of a partial solar eclipse, and we'll have details. County health officials are warning about a second measles case in our region. And in El Cajon, police have arrested a registered sex offender caught with child porn. We've got several newsmaker interviews today. First, with Branson Harper and Patrick Watkins, our own reporters who've been out at the border interviewing migrants in Hakumba, and they've got some fascinating stories to share. Then we'll be interviewing Juliana Girgis. She is the newly appointed leader of the Chaldean Community Council, and she's also an elected member of the Cajon Valley School Board. On Destination East County, we'll have some amazing April events coming up across our region. And then from California News Service, hear how efforts to ban cell phones among students is working out in a pilot program. From Public News Service, we'll have some national news stories today, including a Supreme Court case on criminalizing homelessness that could have major repercussions across the U.S., a key decision in the Trump classified documents case, an update on the Baltimore Bridge collapse, and more. And finally, we'll have some bee safety tips for you with honeybees on the move this spring season. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show, where East County matters.
A new storm is bringing rain and snow to our region. The snow level is forecast to reach as low as 3,000 feet by Friday night. Mount Laguna could receive 3 to 4 inches of snow, with up to 2 inches in Julian. Interstate 8 east of Alpine could also get snow, so use caution if traveling in this area. Pine Valley, Cuyamaca, and Warner Springs are among the areas where you may find snow if you're looking for some snow play after the storm passes. The weekend will bring drier weather, but a new storm system Monday, April 8th is predicted to bring gusty winds and rain showers, though with warmer temperatures. All of this rain and snow is good news for our region and state from a drought-ending perspective. The San Diego County Water Authority said Tuesday that two wet winters combined with regional investments and conservation mean San Diego County has enough water to meet the region's needs for 2024 and the foreseeable future, Times of San Diego reports. Statewide, California's vital snowpack has risen to 10% higher than normal in this year's final scheduled survey by the State Department of Water Resources on April 2nd. Governor Gavin Newsom was on hand for the traditional manual survey at Phillips Station near Lake Tahoe, where a snow depth of 64 inches was measured, 13% greater than normal for that location. It's the second year in a row that California's snowpack has exceeded normal, and the focus now shifts to forecasting the spring water runoff. California Department of Water Resources Director Carla Nemeth calls the levels great news, adding, "This water year shows once again how our climate is shifting and how we can swing from dry to wet conditions within a season." She says conservation is crucial to manage runoff, adding, "Capturing and storing what we can in wetter years for drier times remains a key priority." The Sierra snowpack supplies about 30% of California's water needs. Its natural ability to store water is why the snowpack is often referred to as the state's frozen reservoir. Thanks to a wet winter, the water levels in reservoirs statewide are also up 16% above average for this time of year, which is good news for all Californians. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Danita Ramirez.
The San Diego Registrar of Voters has posted final results from San Diego's March primary election with all ballots now counted. The 75th and 79th assembly races had outcomes change several days after the early election night results, flipping those outcomes. In the 79th Assembly District, where three Democrats were vying to run off in the November general election, La Mesa Councilman Colin Parent clinched first place with almost 40% of the vote. The second place spot, however, ended with educator Lachey Sharp Collins nudging out Lemon Grove Mayor Raquel Vasquez by just 121 votes. Sharp Collins and Vasquez each had just over 30%. In the 75th Assembly District, two Republicans who collectively pulled over 61% of the vote will run off in November. Carl DeMaio, founder of the conservative action group Reform California and a former San Diego councilman, finished first with almost 43% of the vote. He will run off against Andrew Hayes, a Lakeside school board member who has served as staffer to State Senator Brian Jones and Supervisor Joel Anderson. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, has announced federal disaster assistance to supplement state, tribal, and local recovery efforts in California areas affected by severe storm and flooding from January 21st to January 23rd, including the San Diego County. Effective immediately, HUD is providing 90-day moratorium on foreclosures of mortgages insured by the Federal Housing Administration, or FHA, as well as foreclosures of mortgages to Native American borrowers granted the Indian Home Loan Guarantee Program. There are also 90-day extensions granted automatically for the home equality conservation mortgages. Homeowners affected by the disaster should contact their mortgage or loan service immediately for assistance. Conventional mortgage holders may be eligible for additional relief through their mortgage holder. You can call FHA Resource Center at 1-800-304-9320 for additional information. For those whose homes destroyed or severely damaged, HUD also has a program for FHA insurance, allowing disaster victims to get 100% financing through approved lenders and reconstruction or replacement. HUD also provides counselors offering help for disaster victims in over 200 languages. In addition, HUD can also help disaster relief victims facing home discrimination. For more information, visit hud.gov. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Zara Von Ali.
Alex Bowen of Santee, former captain of the Santana High School water polo team, is heading to the Paris Olympics on Team USA's water polo team. His father, Rod Bowen, coaches Santana's water polo team. Now a GoFundMe page has been set up to help Coach Bowen and his wife, Barb, travel to watch their son at the Summer Olympics. The effort was launched by Melissa Harmon, whose three sons have all been mentored by Coach Bowen. She says, "Coach Bowen's love for the game and the way he inspires young men to be the best they can be makes him a favorite of players and parents." Harmon says, "He immensely cares about his players, both in and out of the water. Now is our chance to give back to Coach and Barb." Alex Bowen is considered one of the best shooters on Team USA, according to the USA Water Polo's team's website. He scored over 200 goals while at Stanford and was named a first-team All-American all 4 years. He captained Santana's water polo team as a junior and senior, helping lead Santana several league titles. He holds CIF San Diego section record for the most career goals scored at 547. He was named to All-American in all California teams. Later, he played club water polo for the San Diego Shores, and after participating in the Junior Olympics, he was named Junior Olympics All-American from 2008 through 2011. At Stanford University, he scored over 200 goals and was named to the NCAA first team and multiple All-American teams. He has since competed in numerous international competitions and currently plays professionally in France. On the Team USA website, he states, "I've always wanted to get the most out of the sport I love. I would like to thank my mom for being there and supporting me through the stressful times," adding that he also thanks those who have mentored him and the friendships he's made in the sport. If you would like to donate to help Coach Bowen and his wife go to Paris to watch their son compete in the 2024 Summer Olympics, you can donate on the GoFundMe page titled "Help the Bowen Water Polo Family." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Danita Ramirez.
A partial solar eclipse will create a celestial spectacle in San Diego skies on Monday, April 8th, the last chance to get a glimpse of the solar eclipse in the continental U.S. for 20 years. But be sure to use eclipse safety glasses to protect your eyes if you want to view the eclipse live. A solar eclipse occurs when the moon phases between the sun and the earth. In ancient times, an eclipse could cause a panic since people didn't understand what caused the sun to suddenly disappear and darkness to occur during the daytime. In San Diego, the eclipse will cover 55% of the sun. According to Ruben H., Fleet Space Theater astronomer Lisa Will, Associated Press reports, the eclipse will begin at 10:03 a.m., peaking at 11:11 a.m. locally, concluding at 12:23 p.m. It will start in Mexico, creating a path of darkness as it moves northeast towards Maine. With a total eclipse in 15 states and a partial eclipse visible outside the total eclipse path, the Julian Dark Sky Network will host a solar eclipse viewing party Monday, April 8th, starting at 10 a.m. at the Julian Library. The event is open to the public and includes eclipse viewing glasses. They will have solar telescopes set up for viewing the sunspots, flares, and granular photosphere of our nearest star, the sun. Inside, there will be a slideshow presentation of the night sky and astrophotography images celebrating International Dark Sky Week. NASA advises that you inspect your eclipse glasses before use. If torn or scratched or otherwise damaged, discard the device. Always supervise children using the solar viewers. Do not look at the sun through camera lenses, telescope, binoculars, or any other optical device while wearing eclipse glasses, or use a handheld solar viewer. Solar rays will burn through the filter and cause serious eye injury unless a special solar filter is attached. Across the nation, NASA has teamed up with a variety of solar eclipse educational and viewing events, such as NASA scientists throwing out the first pitch at several Major League Baseball games, showing the eclipse on live screens in Times Square, New York, and the Indianapolis Motor Speedway hosting an eclipse viewing event. Several national parks are hosting eclipse events, and NASA is also working with Google on new eclipse content on arts and culture and other Google pages. For more information, you can visit go.nasa.gov/eclipse2024. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Zaravan Ali.
This is Danita Ramirez with a health alert. An adult who contracted measles overseas may have exposed others to measles in late March at multiple locations in Encinitas and Carlsbad, the County of San Diego Health and Human Services Agency announced Sunday. Dr. Ankita Kadakia, the County Deputy Public Health Officer, says measles is a very contagious disease that can be spread easily by coughing, sneezing, or being in the same room with an infected person. This is the second measles case in San Diego County this year. The earlier case involved an unvaccinated infant who has also traveled overseas. These cases are not linked. The adult is currently hospitalized but may have exposed others between March 22nd and March 30th at these locations in Encinitas: Scripps Encinitas Hospital Emergency Department, Scripps Coastal Medical Center, Ralph's and Trader Joe's stores, Naked Cafe in Encinitas, the Leo Mullins Sports Park, and the Jehovah's Witnesses Kingdom Hall. Visitors to the Tin Leaf Fresh Kitchen in Carlsbad may have also been exposed. Anyone who was exposed should watch for symptoms and call their healthcare provider if they show any signs of the disease. Call your doctor's office in advance so that infection control measures may be activated to prevent exposing others when you visit. Measles develops 7 to 21 days after exposure. Early symptoms include fever, cough, runny nose, and red eyes. The distinctive red rash usually appears 1 to 4 days after early symptoms appear. A person is considered contagious 4 days before and 4 days after the rash appears. The rash typically begins on the face and head, then moves to the hands and feet. Complications from measles are more common in children, including diarrhea, ear infection, and pneumonia. Death can occur from severe complications. There is no treatment for measles. Bed rest, fluids, and fever control are recommended. People with complications may need a treatment for their specific problems. There are measles outbreaks currently in 46 nations and 17 U.S. states. The Centers for Disease Control recently updated its guidelines to urge all travelers over 6 months of age to make sure they are fully vaccinated against measles before going to a foreign country. If you've never been vaccinated, you'll need 2 doses, given 4 weeks apart, so be sure to plan ahead to stay safe.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Zaravon Ali with the Crime Beat Report. El Cajon police have arrested a registered sex offender for possession of child pornography and drugs. Alexander Igles was homeless and living in his vehicle when officers contacted him on March 20th regarding a vehicle code violation. After learning that Igles was on probation for possessing child pornography and selling drugs, officers conducted a compliance search and found graphic child pornography images on his phone, as well as methamphetamines in his possession. Igles is a 37-year-old originally from Escondido. He was booked into San Diego County Jail on multiple felony charges and violating terms of his probation, according to Lieutenant Nick Sepigo with the El Cajon Police Department.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso, the network for social justice. And today I am delighted to welcome Branson Harper and Patrick Watkins, our reporting team, who's just come back from spending several days down there at the border in the Humboldt Hot Springs area, interviewing migrants and people that are helping them there. So welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah, thank you very much for having us.
So you guys really kind of win our Enterprising Reporter of the Year award here, I think, for the idea you came up with for how to communicate with the migrants. We've had other people go out, not only from our news network, from others, but they usually only wind up talking to the people that can already speak English or maybe Spanish because the reporters don't speak, you know, Chinese and Russian and all these other languages. So tell us how you cope with that obstacle and overcame it.
Well, we actually went out with a vlogging tripod and our own little microphone, and we went out using Google Translate, using different multiple language. We spoke to them in, we attempted to speak to them in Chinese, but I spoke Spanish to a couple from Latin America and such, and we spoke using Google Translate for Turkish people. We spoke to a group of Turkish guys, used it for that, and
we got lucky, though, most of the time. A big chunk of the people that we talked to were able to speak English to us, or they had one person in the group who could translate, but the Google Translate really came in handy when we were trying to speak to the Chinese migrants and the people from Asia, or I assume from China, because they spoke Mandarin.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So you headed out eight, you found the tent camp out there, with had everything, including portable bathrooms, set up. I understand one of the first people you spoke with was Samuel Schultz, who's been heading up efforts to actually provide humanitarian aid for the migrants crossing in that area. Can you tell us a little bit more about this guy and his efforts?
Yeah, he's actually been interviewed on local news stations before, such as ABC and such, like from around late last year to early this year.
Ours too, a long time ago, but go ahead.
Yeah, and he's been active for several months, you know, helping them, giving them peanut butter sandwiches and water and some daily supplies, you know, aiding them. And he's part of like one of the larger teams of a network of like migrant aids and helpers that have been helping them.
There seems to be like a group of like a network of different NGOs and different nonprofits. Mm-hmm. So it's not just like Red Cross or not just one group. It's like a whole network of different people that are coming together. And so one day you might go out there and it might be one group of people that are helping feed them. Could be three different groups. Could be Red Cross. We saw Red Cross the last day that we were out there.
I've got to give a little shout out to Rebecca Person, who's another one of our reporters who's not here today, but she actually broke the story of migrants coming across at Hakumba in large numbers last April. I never forget it. I was on vacation in Africa at the time, and I got the call from her, Miriam, there's like 1,000 migrants at the border here. But anyway, she broke a huge story where she discovered that Border Patrol was just sort of corralling these people into open air places. It was like 100, 110 degrees. They were not being given water, food, shade, nothing. It was a really dangerous situation. And her story, which won a major journalism award, by the way, led to a nonprofit group that specializes in migrant issues coming out there and documenting what they claim are violations of both international law and U.S. law as far as the treatment of the migrants from humanitarian aid, and they filed a federal complaint over that. So, yeah, the reporting like what you guys are doing and what Rebecca did can really make a difference.
Yeah, and what Sam was actually telling us and what we heard from a lot of the migrants is that now what Border Patrol is doing essentially is when people come across the border, like they'll be parked right there watching them climb over the rock or maybe up the road like 5 or 10 minutes.
And we should clarify, by the way, that these particular groups are people generally that are seeking asylum here. They're not the ones that are trying to evade the border patrol and come in secret.
Nobody was at all trying to evade border patrol, and border patrol wasn't detaining them necessarily. It's a weird
lingo
what border patrol has been doing is they will count everybody that comes across the border, do like a head count. If there's any Chinese migrants amongst that group,
they'll split them off.
They'll immediately split off the Chinese.
Yeah, we don't know why, but they're doing that.
We don't know why. They wouldn't, for obviously reasons, they wouldn't tell us, but they immediately split off the Chinese migrants, and they kind of shepherd everybody up the road to where the NGOs have set up the camp, and they're telling everybody else that they're not doing that or that they're not telling them that they're detained there. It's a weird lingo situation.
No one really understands the situation.
Yeah, on one hand, Border Patrol, we're being told, is saying publicly that they aren't detaining them there, that they're going there at their own free will. But they're being told if they leave that particular area, it'll affect their asylum claim.
And they can get deported, yeah.
And so it's like kind of a wink, wink, nod, nod, where Border Patrol is kind of shepherding them up the road to where the NGOs are at. And
yeah, and I think when the NGOs take them other places, at some point there's credible fear interviews that are done, I understand, to find out whether they have a legitimate, you know, possible asylum claim, and they're treated one way, and if somebody doesn't, then those are the ones that could be deported.
Yeah, we're not fully aware of the process. We did get some contact information for one of the fellows that we interviewed, Amir. Mm-hmm. He's from the Russian Federation.
Yeah, we'll get to the details on each migrant in a minute.
We're going to try and get a hold of him and see what the actual process looks like of the detaining, but
great. Yeah, I understand you're going to follow up with some of these guys you talked with and women, so that's great. Back to Sam Schultz for a minute. He actually started a GoFundMe page. It's called Hakumba Migrant Camps, and I just checked it. He's raised over $52,000 since he started this last year. So that's just community donations to make sure people aren't like starving. You know, there were people coming across with babies and young children and no food or water.
Yeah, a lot of families. Small families, but large families too.
Yeah, a lot of women and children.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about some of the specifics. You know, there were hundreds of people out there. You guys wanted to hear the stories directly from the migrants. Let's start with the young men from Turkey, Salim, Hassan, and Muhammad, who you interviewed. Tell us their story.
Yeah, they all came from different parts of Turkey separately, but when we saw them, they seemed very jovial and willing to talk to us. And they give us all our stories, which they actually had good careers back in Turkey in like office jobs such as IT, computing, and one of them was even an engineer at a Rolls-Royce factory.
Yeah, but then the economy in Turkey went south.
Hasn't been as good lately, and so they fled, and like some of them said they fled because due to the current president Erdogan policies over there.
Yeah,
increasingly oppressive political climate.
I was actually in Turkey last year, believe it or not, on my way back from
Africa. I was right next to Turkey.
Africa. Yeah, so we heard a lot about that. He's been getting more conservative, and there's crackdowns on what women
a lot of people, especially lately with his moves such as turning the Hagia Sophia back into a mosque. Even a lot of Turks have, like, I've spoken to.
Right, for a long time it had been a museum. Exactly. One of them, Muhammad, I guess, when you guys ask him about why he decided to come now to America, he said it was because of he felt like Biden was more welcoming than maybe.
Yeah, he willingly said it.
Yeah, one of the questions we asked or tried to ask everybody was, are they worried at all about, you know, potentially their asylum claims not being met or not being processed? Or what made them really want to come to this country? And for them in particular, they're quick to say, like, thumbs up for Joe Biden.
Yeah,
you know, Joe's our guy.
It's very interesting. And they were like so open about it. They're like, yeah. And they're like, oh, are you worried it's going to take a long time to get it? Like, no, no. They seemed so like they were well informed and researched the topic.
And they all had a destination too. Everybody we asked already knew where they wanted to go. These fellas in particular.
Did they have family here?
I don't believe they did.
That particular group did not. Some of the folks we talked to did. But the Turkish fellows, they didn't have family from what we heard. One wanted to go, the IT worker wanted to go to LA, and the other two fellows wanted to go to New York.
Yeah, it's kind of a myth. Sometimes people worry that, oh my gosh, we're going to have all these migrants winding up like homeless, adding to our homelessness problem in San Diego. But the NGOs that are helping them tell us that almost all of them wind up moving on to somewhere else.
Yeah, that's what they told us. That's what they said. I asked one of them one time, like, oh, where do you do you guys know where they're going to go? And they're like, well, they just kind of go where they want. We kind of help them sometimes.
Yeah, a lot of them just want a bus ticket to go join family.
Yeah, that's what they do.
Every single person that we talked to, none of them said San Diego was their final destination. They usually said
New York.
New York seemed to be the big hot spot for them.
Okay. Let's talk about Gladys, who was a 45-year-old Honduran migrant. Tell us about her long and difficult journey.
Yeah, she said it took her months to get over here. She fled like Honduras because, you know, similar authoritarian stuff over there, but also because, you know, lack of jobs over there, which seems to be a common theme. A lot of people, you know, when they start to come to the U.S. But she said, yeah, she fled because there was just more economic opportunities over here.
And the gang problems in Honduras.
Fearing persecution, she said.
And she said she was afraid to go back. And she's afraid for the family that remained because, they could be targeted for persecution by their authoritarian-leaning government.
And you also, this was interesting, you found a migrant family from Portugal, of all places.
Yeah, that was crazy. That was, like, interesting because after Turkey, I was like, oh, yeah, like, Turkey was a surprise for us. But then we met this family from Portugal, and I was like, whoa. I was like, Portugal? My dad was just there.
Why did they come here?
It's the same thing, you know, economic, you know, opportunity.
So more economic migrants for the case.
People that we talked to, just about everybody, I would say, even if there was an element of fear of like going back to their country, a big concern they had was economic.
Yeah. So you were telling me that a lot of them made their way. This isn't necessarily people like, you know, trekking up from Central America. A lot of them had flown over here from Europe, from Asia.
The Hondurans were the only ones that actually made the trek from Honduras by foot or by bus. Everybody else that we talked to flew from their home country.
Yeah. Usually to TJ. Well, they would go multiple ways. Like the Portuguese family, for instance, flew from... Flew to Mexico City and then took another flight from Cancun. Cancun, and then from Cancun to TJ.
It's interesting that instead of going to the well-known border crossing in San Ysidro, the busiest in the world, that they're winding up here in Jacumba. So are they paying, you know, traffickers to sort of ferry them across, or did they just find it?
Go ahead. Slightly deeper story where they all, like multiple sources there, confirmed that they were. Most likely, they paid cartel people because they're armed with guns, and even some even had silencers, according to one Russian migrant said.
Yeah, Amir, who you talked to. His story was really interesting. He said these people might even be cartel members, but I guess they just didn't ask.
We didn't want to ask him too many questions about that and go too hard and get anyone in trouble, but what he described to us is basically there's a process where you go to a hotel or you go to an area that's kind of known to have smugglers of some kind, whether they're organized or just independent smugglers. Mm-hmm. And all you have to do is pay them $250 at TJ and they drive you out through Mexicali.
Because it can be thousands if they're coming all the way from Central America, but $250 if you can get to the border. Huh?
$250 for this particular group. You know, I don't know if that's the going rate, and then you get driven out to La Rumorosa, dropped off quite literally right at that little...
gap in the fence there where the old fence ends and the new fence starts. And just like climb through or over. People may be surprised to hear that there's somebody coming here all the way from Russia. And his story was really interesting. Tell us about that.
Yeah, he's a fascinating character. He's only 19. He's one of the youngest ones we met. You know, he's 19 by himself. And he fled Russia from a little small industrial town called Lipetsk, you know. Mm-hmm. And he fled because he was experienced increasing political persecution over there, over the Ukraine war.
Yeah, he told us that he didn't agree with fighting in the Ukraine, and he said he didn't really want to pick a side. He wasn't particularly pro-Russia or pro-Ukraine. He just didn't believe in the war.
Mm-hmm. And the invasion, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he was a current college student, but because of his anti-war beliefs, he was being threatened with expulsion from school, which would then result in immediate drafting and sent to the war.
And then he actually got beat up, you said. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I did. In Russia, I mean, he got threatened by thugs to support the war because he didn't really want to do
Putin,
it. And then he said, because Russia's starting to have increasingly desperate measures over there, that they're really starting to, like, you know, try to draft people. And he was afraid of that, too.
Yeah, and there was just a lot of social pressure, he said. He even told us he wasn't part of any movements. He didn't participate in any group meetings or anything that would really kind of paint a target on your back from the state. He was just outspoken enough to the point where...
They didn't like that.
They didn't... The Russian people didn't really like that. And it caused him to flee.
Yeah, I think it's just the doubling down of like Russian society and the government in general. Because it's like, you know, like they've gotten to the point where they're like, you know, if you don't support the war, you have to get out of here.
It's really bad news.
You know,
it is tragic. There were a number of Asian migrants coming across, at least some of whom confirmed to you that they are Chinese.
Well, so here's the thing. None of them would really say anything to us beyond no thank you.
But or I'm from
they
China.
Spoke Mandarin. We asked them first, like, do you speak Mandarin? And all of them said yes. And then we would use Google Translate to ask them the question.
And they usually weren't too... They'd usually, most of them didn't want to talk to us at all, but some of them did. And then one older guy was very friendly and he was talking to us, but then we asked for an interview and he immediately turned away.
He's like, no. It seemed some of them were more friendly and willing to at least say, yes, I speak Mandarin. And then others, as soon as we walked up, they were just cold faced, didn't want to talk to us. One fellow even pulled his hat down over his head and walked away, hand on his face.
And it's really odd that the Border Patrol, we've heard this from other people too, that when the Chinese come over, they are separating them from the other migrants for some reason.
Yeah, it was very strange. Almost immediately upon when they crossed, they just kind of split them off.
Yeah, so the Border Patrol will keep buses or keep cars on hand in the area to bus the migrants to whatever processing facility that they take them
Correct.
To. We don't really know where that is for sure. We asked them, but they wouldn't confirm that.
Right.
But if they have enough bus capacity at the time, they take the Chinese migrants immediately. Or if they don't and there's more Chinese than non-Chinese, they'll take the non-Chinese first.
I know you guys tried to ask Border Patrol about this and they didn't want to answer. So if any of our listeners out there have firsthand knowledge of this, maybe there's an immigration lawyer or someone out there listening who can tell us more about the stories and what's happening with the Chinese migrants when they come over. We would love to hear it.
Yeah, we're thinking about possibly diving deeper into that and contacting Border Patrol or like, you know, some of the agencies. The one Border Patrol agent that was willing to say a few words that we're willing to get through, he was saying, they just really can't say much.
He was very friendly, but he was very vague with his answers and it was very clear that it wasn't his intention. It was something... Some sort of higher up.
Yeah, they're not trying to be in the spotlight.
I'm kind of curious, you know, when you guys first went out to do this assignment, did it change your own perspective or thinking? You know, what were your expectations going out there or based on what you'd heard or read elsewhere? And did it change things when you actually, you know, met some of the migrants face to face and talked with them?
Yeah, I think it did surprise us a little bit because it brought out more of the human element to all of it. You know, it's like we went and... Sometimes the news, they just dehumanize things.
Yeah, it sounds like it's like hordes of invaders.
Yeah, that type of stuff, you know?
You don't really get the full image, whether it's like watching something like CNN, where, everyone's like friendly, or you watch Fox News and it's like all the hordes of migrants, you know, you have to kind of go there for yourself and talk to them. And it definitely humanizes them and makes them into people instead of just...
And many of them, you know, you could see like... the goodness of them, be like, oh, this is a good person. You know, I bid them like hope. I bid them farewell and I hope they can do good and succeed in this country.
Almost everyone we talked to that came here wanted to start a good life and just wanted to work, you know.
Productive members of society.
They just wanted to kind of chase the American dream.
Well, and listeners, you can read more about this on eastcountymagazine.org in our Refugee Voices section. We're probably the only publication in the whole world newspaper that has a Refugee Voices section, but San Diego has more refugees from around the world than any other county in the United States, so they have their own section. I just want to wrap up by reading the last sentence that Branson, who authored the story, wrote, and both of you guys were out there doing the interviews and the, you know, the photos. You concluded, all of these migrants, whether seeking jobs, freedom from war, or persecution, hope to find safety and security within the United States of America, while also being aware of the necessity of successful assimilation into the land of the free. Beautiful writing.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I'm going to give you the last word. Is there anything else that you'd like our listeners to know?
Yeah, you know, we would love to follow up on the story, and we plan to do follow up, especially with one of the Russian migrant, Amir. We'll follow through his journey across the U.S. and his asylum process, so... We'll write more articles about
that. Yeah, that's great, because we're always wondering when we read the stories, what happens to them? Do they stay? Do they leave?
Yeah, I think that everyone we talked to, like I said, would probably be a really great person to like live next to. They seem like really nice people. And I just hope that whatever the situation is, that it can get remedied somehow so these people can find some sort of pathway to security. Because right now, it's a really insecure situation, and there's no... there's no real good off ramp in sight. Yeah, and it's not good to have the cartels, I think, involved. I think
no, it's not.
Whatever way we can to try and legalize this process and make it more,
streamline it.
Make it so these people aren't in political limbo, because you hear stories about how they get here, but a lot of these people were expecting to work. And
well, and some don't get here. They get like kidnapped along the way, especially the ones walking from Central America.
Or trafficked. A lot of people are running into work visa issues, and so I really just hope that these people, they don't get here and then get screwed over somehow by politics
or coming all this way and paying all this money and then getting deported. Efforts. The Biden administration has been trying to get comprehensive immigration reform through Congress. And, ironically, he finally agreed to a bill that had pretty much almost everything the Republicans had been asking for, as far as hiring like hundreds of new border agents and strengthening border security in order to also get a better process for people to apply, so they wouldn't have to, come around the world to apply. You could apply where you are for asylum, and then a certain number would get in, and it would also have protected like Dreamers and things like that. And unfortunately, the Republicans were ready to vote for it, actually, and Donald Trump asked them not to, because he wants to do immigration changes when he comes in as president, but it would probably be more along the lines of this tightening security only and not addressing the humanitarian angle for the refugees coming here.
Yeah, that would be interesting to see how this whole situation plays out along the border, because it's just very odd, very vague and mysterious how the Border Patrol and the cartel all play a role in the NGOs, the volunteers and stuff. So we'll have to get back more to you on that.
It's an ongoing story, and I'm sure we're going to have lots of future coverage. So listeners, if you tuned in late, we've been speaking with Branson Harper and Patrick Watkins, our reporting team here at East County Magazine, who spent several days down at the border interviewing migrants hoping for a new life in America. I want to thank both of you for taking the time to join us here today on the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
You're listening to the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for San Diego's inland region. Now, stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. Today, my very special guest is Joliana Gergis. She is the new executive director of the Chaldean Community Council. Joliana fled religious persecution in Iraq, coming to America when she was just 19 years old and pregnant at the time. Connecting through other Chaldeans here, she learned about the Diego Valley Charter School, where she learned English and obtained a high school diploma. She went on to earn both a bachelor's and master's degree in counseling at San Diego State University, and now she's giving back to help other newcomers to America at the Chaldean Council, where she has expanded the nonprofit to help refugee and immigrant families in El Cajon, including during the pandemic, when the organization provided a lot of help to people in need. She's also the winner of the San Diego Metro Magazine's 40 Under 40 Award and an elected member of the Cajon Valley Union School District Board. Joliana, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Miriam.
What were conditions like in your homeland in Iraq that drove you and your husband to come to America when you were so young and 6 months pregnant at the time?
Condition in Iraq promoted us to come to America when I was 19 and pregnant. It was a difficult decision, but we couldn't stay there. It wasn't safe for us as a family.
Yeah, that's, I think, a very common experience for a lot of refugees coming in from around the world. So what was it like to arrive here in America as a newcomer who didn't speak English? And how did you survive and become so successful?
Arriving in America as a newcomer who didn't speak English was challenging. But the hard work and support from the community, we managed to thrive and succeed.
Good for you. And now I'd like to introduce one of our wonderful, talented interns, Danera Ramirez, who is from Grossmont College, where I know you worked for a long time. Danera has a couple of questions for you.
How did your time at Diego Valley School influence your life?
My time at Diego Valley School greatly influenced my life by providing me with a solid foundation and supportive environment.
How helpful was your time at Grossmont College in preparing you for your higher education?
Grossmont College played a crucial role in preparing me for higher education, offering valuable resources and education opportunities.
So who does the Chaldean Community Council help?
We help everybody, not just Chaldean people. The doors are open for like all people, all communities, whoever needs help with anything.
Can you tell us about some of the programs and the assistance the organization provides?
Sure. We do everything for people, like anything they need help with, from looking for job applications, reading their mail, reading their email, applying for medical, for CalFresh, CalWorks, applying for college, any help with any job application, anything. We help people, especially non-English speakers, mm-hmm. who needs help all the time, and they come to our center looking for help.
That's great. That's so important for new refugees and immigrants coming here. So what prompted you to start the computer literacy program and a program to help people find health insurance, Juliana?
Some programs provided include computer literacy training and assistance with finding health insurance. We started those programs to address specific needs within the community and promote empowerment and well-being, especially during challenging time like COVID pandemic.
Yeah, tell us about that. What were some of the things you did during the COVID pandemic to help the community?
During COVID pandemic, we collaborated with SDSU, other organization, and health. We provided health information to people. We were trying to reach as many community members as possible to make sure people are getting the help during the pandemic.
That's great. So I want to introduce another of our wonderful interns from Grossmont College, Zaravan Ali. And Zaravan has some questions for you as well.
Hello. You're also an elected member of the Cajon Valley Union School District Board of Directors. What prompted you to run, and what's your experience been like serving as a trustee?
I run for Cajon Valley Union District as a board of director to contribute positively of education and present the interest of the community. Serving as a trustee has been a good experience for me and also helping my community.
All right. And what ideas do you have that you would like to see implemented?
I have several ideas for improvement in the Cajon Valley District, including enhancing technology in a classroom and expanding access to the community, being that person who can connect the community with the district.
All right, and what are your future goals and aspirations, both personally and for the Chaldean Community Council?
My future goals include further improving education in the district and advising the initiatives of the Chaldean Community Council.
Yeah, that's all very important. So, Juliana, how can people get involved with the Chaldean Community Council if they want to help out?
People can get involved with the Chaldean Community Council by volunteering their time, donating resources, or participate in the event and the programs.
Great. And folks, you can find more information at chaldeancouncil.org. Juliana, I'm going to let you have the last word today. What else would you like our audience to know?
I would like the audience to know that their support can make difference in lives of individuals and families within the Chaldean community.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Thank you.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Welcome to East County Magazine's Destination East County, bringing you all of the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County each week.
This is Miriam Raftery.
And I'm Danita Ramirez.
With this week's Destination East County, April brings some awesome events to East County, including Daffodil Days in Julian, a stargazing party at Mission Trails, the opening of the Cajon Classic Cruises season, Ramona's Open Studios Art Tour, Latino musical headliners at Viejas Concerts in the Park, Heritage of the Americas Museum's Spring Art Show, stand-up comedian Kevin Hart at the Magnolia, Lakeside's Rodeo and Western Days Parade, and a Neil Young concert at San Diego State University. Julian Farm and Orchard invites you to enjoy Daffodil Days every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from 10 o'clock to 4 p.m. now through April 14th or whenever those beautiful yellow blooms are gone. The farm offers you-pick daffodils as well as other farm activities including a petting zoo, tractor-pulled hay rides, plus you can do axe throwing, climb a rock climbing wall, and shop at the gift store with locally crafted items as well as potted daffodils for sale. You can get more information at julianfarmandorchard.com.
Mission Trails Regional Park and the San Diego Astronomy Association invites you to a star party on the first Friday of each month starting at sunset at the Kumeyaay Lake Campground parking lot. The next star party is on April 5th. Telescopes will be available to view the nighttime sky, including stars, planets, and constellations, weather permitting. Find more information at Mission Trails Regional Park's website at mtrp.org.
Cajon Classic Cruises opens their season on Wednesday night, April 10th, with a full street closure for the car shows at Main and Magnolia in downtown El Cajon, along with plenty of food, fun, and entertainment for the whole family. Cajon Classic Cruises will continue all summer long every Wednesday night. For a full schedule of events, you can visit downtownelcajon.com.
On Saturday and Sunday, April 13th and 14th, the Ramona Chamber of Commerce will present the annual Ramona Open Studios Tour. You will have a unique opportunity to visit with Ramona artists in their private studios while viewing their work. This self-guided tour will meander through Ramona, allowing visitors to explore at their own pace from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Participating artists showing a variety of artistic expressions, including painting, ceramics, jewelry, sculptures, fused glass, and woodworking, which will be available for purchase. For tickets, visit ramonachamber.com.
Concerts in the Park at Viejas and Alpine return starting April 19th with a performance by Luis Angel, known as El Flaco, and Luis Antonio, El Mimoso. Then on April 27th, Mariachis Vargas will bring music to Viejas Concerts in the Park. More concerts are planned in May, June, and July. For tickets and a full schedule, you can visit viejas.com/entertainment.
The City of La Mesa is inviting residents, visitors, sponsors, and vendors to join its family-friendly Earth Day Fair on Saturday, April 20th at MacArthur Park. The festival is a celebration of the city's commitment to environmental stewardship and a showcase of local businesses that offer eco-friendly products and services. The festival will run from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. and feature a variety of activities for all ages and interests.
Heritage of the Americas Museum at Cuyamaca College will host a spring art show with a reception on April 20th from 12 noon to 4 p.m. featuring talented artists from the Cuyamaca Art Club. Their works will feature topics related to the Americas in mediums ranging from paintings to digital art to charcoal creations. Learn more at heritageoftheamericasmuseum.com.
Actor and comedian Kevin Hart will perform live at the Magnolia in El Cajon on April 21st with two shows at 6 p.m. and 8 p.m. Hart has been a guest host on Saturday Night Live, hosted the MTV Music Video Awards, won several stand-up comedy competitions, and founded the Laugh Out Loud Comedy Streaming Network. He's also an accomplished actor with starring roles in many motion pictures, including the Jumanji series, Scary Movie, Fast and Furious, and more. In 2015, the Time magazine named him 100 Most Influential People in the World. For tickets, visit magnoliasandiego.com.
Lakeside's annual rodeo will be held April 25th through 28th, featuring events such as bronco and bull riding, barrel racing, and more. A tradition for more than a century, the rodeo began back in 1920, and today benefits youth groups in the Lakeside community. Tickets are available at lakesiderodeo.com.
Lakeside's Western Days Parade rolls out on Saturday, April 27th, starting at 9:35 a.m. The parade route starts on Woodside Avenue and proceeds down Main Avenue. This year's theme is Lakeside, a great small town. The parade is organized by the the Lakeside Chamber of Commerce, and you can find more information at lakesidechamber.org.
Legendary musician Neil Young and his band Crazy Horse will perform live at the Cal Coast Credit Union Open Air Theater at San Diego State University on April 27th. The winner of multiple Grammy Awards, Neil Young has previously performed with such big-name bands as Crosby, Stills & Nash and Buffalo Springfield. His hit songs include Freedom, Philadelphia, and Harvest Moon. Tickets are available at as.sdsu.edu/calcoast or just Google Cal Coast Open Air Theater for details.
That's all for this week. We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
Separating high school students from their cell phones might be seen as a daunting task, but one California school says having students stash them during the school day has brought some surprising results. Administrators at High Tech High in San Diego say fostering a phone-free school environment has brought surprising results. Starting this school year, High Tech High required students to relinquish their phones at the beginning of the day. School compliance officer Colleen Green says tracking student perceptions and observing the impact of cell phones on the learning culture provides a compelling case study.
Where before they were sitting in those spaces and kind of heads down into their technology, they're now sitting in those spaces and having conversations. There's a lot more engagement and conversation in class because students are talking to each other and they're not listening to their AirPods.
Across the country, more than three-quarters of K through 12 public schools prohibit non-academic cell phone use, according to a report from the 2021-2022 school year. But only 43% of high schools have such a rule, and it is often not enforced. Doug Keller with the nonprofit organization Youth Truth says it's been tracking students' experiences over the past decade in such areas as engagement, relationships, culture, academic challenges, and their overall sense of belonging. He says once the phones were gone from classes, the majority of students showed improvement in several areas.
When they implemented the policy, we saw a sharp jump upward. We saw growth, students feeling a stronger sense of belonging at their school because of this new policy, after seeing a decline that matched the decline that we have anecdotally seen elsewhere.
Keller says Youth Truth surveyed students to measure the intersection of student voice, school improvement, and key indicators of the student experience. This also includes areas like peer collaboration and relationships with their teachers. He says they will continue the study in the future. For California News Service, I'm Mark Richardson. Find our 8 trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Now we have some national news headlines from Public News Service.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast, April the 5th, 2024. I'm Mike Clifford. A case out of Oregon, soon to be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court, could have a major impact on how cities treat homelessness. The details now from our Eric Tigetoff.
Oral arguments for Johnson versus Grants Pass are scheduled for April 22nd. It concerns an ordinance in the city of Grants Pass that banned people from sleeping in public, including a prohibition on the use of blankets and pillows. Lauren Naldoza is with Oregon Food Bank, which filed an amicus brief with 15 other organizations in the state in support of the plaintiffs. He says homelessness isn't a lifestyle choice.
It's an involuntary state of being because there have been systems or crises like our housing crisis, our cost of living crisis, or personal crises that are impacting people across the state that converge together and make it harder for people to stay stably housed.
The 9th District Court ruled in favor of the plaintiffs that the Grants Pass law violates the 8th Amendment against cruel and unusual punishment. Supporters of the Grants Pass law say cities should be allowed to decide their own policies rather than the federal government.
U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon denied Donald Trump's motion to dismiss the classified documents case based on the Presidential Records Act. That from MSNBC. Their take is that it was the only logical conclusion she could have reached, but her order denying Trump's motion would appear to be a win for Special Counsel Jack Smith at this pre-trial stage, but it still leaves plenty of room for mischief down the road. NBC notes that's because Cannon also denied Smith's request to rule on jury instructions. The reason Smith wanted her to do so was because earlier she had floated the notion of using a fringe legal view based on the Presidential Records Act in those instructions. Meantime, Virginia environmental organizations have united in opposition to Governor Glenn Youngkin's picks for the State Environmental Justice Council.
In the last 2 years, the council has been short several members, unable to reach a quorum or conduct official votes. But critics point out that most of the new appointees have strong ties to the fossil fuel industries that cause environmental harm. Tim Sawinski with the Sierra Club's Virginia chapter says there's no upside to the new appointments.
People tied to the fossil fuel industry are not going to be helpful in initiatives that are meant to reduce pollution and improve public health to make sure that people aren't affected by toxic air from polluting projects, toxic water from polluting projects.
The groups also say new appointees don't meet certain background requirements to be on the council. They've signed a letter asking the General Assembly to reject the appointees. Sawinski suggests instead Youngkin reappoint the people whose terms expired. I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
Based on current environmental impacts, Petersburg residents have a lifespan about a decade lower than the national average. This is Public News Service. With temporary channels open to shallow draft vessels only a week after the collapse of the Key Bridge, officials see a much slower path to accommodating larger ships.
While dismantling the collapsed bridge may seem straightforward from vantage points on land, below the surface of the Patapsco River visibility is poor and the wreckage sits in 5 feet of mud. Crews are using 3D side-scan sonar to conduct engineering analysis and plan next steps, but progress is slow. Baltimore District Army Corps of Engineers Commander Colonel S.T. Pinchason says moving this kind of debris requires constant engineering reassessment.
When we lift a piece of wreckage, we have to go back in and ensure that the stability of the wreckage is the same, that the wreckage didn't shift or didn't act in a different way, because as we're going further and further down, we don't want to create a more precarious situation.
She says cranes operate so close to the wreckage that any unanticipated movement could place salvage teams at risk. Brett Pivoteau reporting.
Meantime, Minnesotans who have not completed their tax returns yet may be fretting about meeting the April 15th deadline. For those facing language barriers or other resource issues, the concern is even greater, but help is available.
In the Twin Cities and around Minnesota, there are free tax preparation sites staffed with multilingual volunteers, including those who speak Spanish. And the organization COPAL provides plenty of tax guidance to Latino populations in the communities it serves. COPAL's Claudia Lyonnez says that includes assisting undocumented individuals as they get ready to file their returns. Despite certain myths, she says they are required to pay taxes like everyone else.
And they pay a lot more taxes because sometimes they are not eligible for credit.
A key change this year is that these households are eligible for Minnesota's new child tax credit. I'm Mike Moen.
Finally, the milk you drink or the beef you eat may have come from a farm that rotates its livestock in a certain way to establish a healthier landscape. Wisconsin farmers who practice managed grazing have another chance for new federal funding. The USDA has announced $22 million available for regional networks of farmers who offer peer-to-peer technical assistance on the practice. When the federal funding was restored last year, Michael Fields Agricultural Institute's Margaret Chrome says the demand was overwhelming.
It really wasn't a very long application period, and we still had a lot of applicants that couldn't get funded because there was just not enough money. And we anticipate that will happen again. We really want to make sure Wisconsin farmers have their organizations apply.
These waves of assistance come after a 15-year absence of federal funding for the Grazing Lands Conservation Initiative. This is Mike Clifford. Thank you for ending your week with Public News Service. Member and listener supported. Hear us on interesting radio stations, your favorite podcast platform. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, and Pond 5.
If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.